Johnny Owens and I were walking back to the car after dinner in Hyde Park, and Johnny was in an expansive mood. He often got like this, especially after a good meal and wine. The first time I met him, when he was still working with the Downtown Civic Group, he had started to explain the relationship between jazz and Eastern religion, then swerved into an analysis of black women's behinds, before coming to a stop on the subject of Federal Reserve Bank policy. In such moments, Johnny's eyes would grow wide, his voice would speed up, his round, bearded face would glow with a childlike wonder. That was part of the reason I'd hired Johnny, I suppose. That curiosity of his appreciation of the absurd. He was a philosopher of the blues. We'd almost reached Johnny's car when we heard a small pop, compact and brief, like a balloon bursting. We looked in the direction of the sound and watched a young man appear from around the corner diagonal to us. I don't clearly recall his features or what he wore, although he couldn't have been older than 15. I just remember that he ran at a desperate pace, his sneakered feet silent against the sidewalk, his lanky limbs pumping wildly, his chest jutting out as if straining for an imaginary tape. Johnny dropped flat onto a small plot of grass in front of one of the apartments, and I quickly followed suit. A few seconds later, two more boys came around the same corner, also running at full speed. One of them, short, fattish, with pants that bunched around his ankles, was waving a small pistol. Without stopping to aim, he let out three quick shots in the direction of the first boy. Then, realizing that his target was out of range, he slowed to a walk, stuffing the weapon under his shirt. His companion, skinny and big-eared, came alongside. "Stupid motherfucker," the skinny boy said. He spat with satisfaction, and the two of them laughed to each other before continuing down the street. Children again, their figures casting squat shadows on the asphalt. I had been in Chicago for over 2 years by this time. The organization had grown, and I had grown with it. Marty had moved on, deciding to try his hand working in a less hostile atmosphere. Working on my own, I had recruited new churches, found new leaders, helped to build new playgrounds and remove asbestos from a local housing project, and expand our job training efforts. Johnny's presence as my deputy had helped relieve my workload, and our budget was stable. What I'd lost in youthful enthusiasm, I made up for in experience. And in fact, it may have been that growing familiarity with the landscape, the council of time, that gave me the sense that something different was going on with the children of the South Side that spring of 1987. That a line had been crossed, a blind and ugly corner turned. There was nothing definite I could point to, no hard statistics. The drive-by shootings, the ambulance sirens, the night sounds of neighborhoods abandoned to drugs and gang war, and phantom automobiles, where police or press rarely ventured until after the body was found on the pavement, blood spreading in a glistening, uneven pool. None of this was new. In the housing projects, prison records had been passed down from father to son for more than a generation. During my very first days in Chicago, I had seen the knots of young men, 15 or 16, hanging out on the corners of Michigan or Halstead, their hoods up, their sneakers unlaced, stomping the ground in a desultory rhythm during the colder months, stripped down to t-shirts in the summer, answering their beepers on the corner payphones, a knot that unraveled, soon to reform, whenever the police cars passed by in their barracuda silence. No, it was more of a change of atmosphere, like the electricity of an approaching storm. I felt it when, driving home one evening, I saw four tall boys walking down a tree-lined block, idly snapping a row of young saplings that an older couple had just finished planting in front of their house. I felt it whenever I looked into the eyes of the young men in wheelchairs who had started appearing on the streets that spring, boys crippled before their prime, their eyes without a trace of self-pity, eyes so composed, already so hardened, that they served to frighten rather than to inspire.